Chris Schwarz is the former editor of Popular Woodworking magazine and one of the geniuses behind woodworking in America. He is considered by most to be the authority on workbenches and is responsible for the popularization of the Rubo design. His latest book, The Anarchist Tool Chest, is taking the woodworking community by storm. You can follow Chris and all of his work at lostartpress.com, as well as his blog at popularwoodworking.com. Chris is here today to answer guild member questions concerning workbenches and the split-top Rubo. How is life after pop woodworking? Is it everything you dreamt it would be?
And more. That and more, Mark. Yeah. It's very busy. And what's really great is that all the books that were I wanted to do are coming together. And I'm working on my next book. I'm working on Peter Follinsby and Jenny Alexander's book. I'm working on Matt Vickford's book. Plus, you know, I got to spend a week with the Studley Tool Chest for Don Williams' book. It's just been, I haven't stopped working. It's just been totally sort of a different out-of-body experience.
That's awesome. So now, will Lost Art Press be doing DVDs? I know one of my favorite things of yours, the work that you put out in a lot of the stuff, are the DVDs that you've made in the past. So I'm curious, are you guys going to do DVDs to accompany some of the texts that you're putting out there?
Well, we're going to have to. We did a DVD to go with the Anarchist Tool Chest, and I'm also working on some other ways of marrying print and video. But I mean, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I got into writing because I can't stand the sound of my voice or the way I look. And there is nothing more frightening to me than being on a video or my voice being recorded.
Oh, no kidding. So I didn't know that.
I was the most shy and frightened little boy, and that's why I got into writing, because nobody ever had to see me.
Yeah.
Thing. I was just a total recluse nerd, and so I've had to do that to sort of, well, make money and eat. And I'm sure we'll have to do DVDs, but you just know that I'm wearing like two extra pairs of Depends when I'm on video.
I mean, the funny thing is that reminds me of my childhood. I was extremely shy as a kid growing up. And the funny thing about what I do is, since I don't have a cameraman, even when I'm on camera, or for, you know, right now, for instance, I'm still by myself. So I can kind of be a ham, which I'm good at doing privately. But when I'm in front of a bunch of people, that's when my introverted side comes out. So I know exactly what you're talking about, but I found a little loophole for myself.
Very interesting. I'll have to explore that.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move into some of the workbench stuff. Obviously, we have a ton of questions here. I don't want to inundate you, but I will. And you know, we're building the split top Rubo version that Benchcrafted has a plan for. We basically are working with them, kind of borrowed the plan, made a SketchUp drawing, and we're making our own version of the plan for that project. And one of the most common questions that I'm getting for folks to ask you is, what are your thoughts on the split top concept in general? And if there's any sort of gotchas that we're not thinking of, why that might not be the best way to go versus a monolithic slab?
Yeah, I get asked that question a lot. And I have not built a split top Rubo, but I have worked on several of them. Mm-hmm. Rainey Nelson has one, and I've worked on his a bit. And Kelly Mailer has a couple of them, and I got to work on those when I was teaching down there. Mm-hmm. And they're fine. There's no functional problem with them. Okay. I mean, also Bob Lang's 21st Century Workbench is somewhat of a split top, though, with it's the giant gaping maw
right
between the two slabs. And you know, it works fine. The reason I have not, you know, embraced it or built one myself is because I'm a simple man. And that when you add the split top is that you add complexity. You have to add stretchers below to support the two independent slabs. Mm-hmm. And so you're introducing some complexity that I've always tried to avoid, and by not having those stretchers between the front and back legs so that you can just slap a slab on there and be done. So I'm always trying to reduce the amount of parts, reduce the amount of work. So basically, I'm too lazy to build a split top Rubo.
Okay. But so I guess bottom line is, if you don't necessarily see the advantages, or you look at the list of quote unquote advantages of having the split top, and if those aren't really, you know, ringing true for you, you might just be better off going with a solid top as opposed to the split top design.
Well, the split top design is cool, and it offers a lot of, you know, advantages if you, you know, if you like sort of the sort of gizmo-esque stuff you can do with it. I mean, it does offer a lot of cool stuff that goes with it.
Yeah.
But as long as you have stable stock, you know, then the split top will work fine and the monolithic slab will work fine. It's the stability of the stock that makes the top work.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it's the reason I was originally attracted to it. In fact, I believe it was Bob Lang's design that I looked at. I'm like, I should design one and do something, you know, Rubo-esque. And then I did a little research and found out that someone already thought of that. So I figured, why not just steal their design and not worry about doing my own? But for me, it was really, there have been times as like sort of I try to dip my toes into both power tool and hand tool woodworking, and my bench gets used for a lot more than just joinery, you know, assembly and different tasks like that. There have been a lot of times with a big workbench where I've just been like, oh, I wish I could put a clamp right in the middle of this to hold this piece down, a very tall piece, for instance. So for me, just clamping alone is where, you know, the real advantage is for that. But again, someone may never have even thought that thought, and it just doesn't necessarily make sense to make more work for themselves just to have the split top in there. So, all right, I got some questions here from the guild members, actually a ton of questions, and we'll just plow right into them. So Brian Brazil asks, he says, I've recently become a little obsessed with the, I always have trouble pronouncing, is it Holtzapfel?
Holtzapfel, yeah.
Okay, pretty close. So he's been obsessed with that bench from your workbench design book. And he says, since he has experience working on both that and the Rubo bench designs, how would you compare the two?
The Rubo bench was designed for joiners, and the Holtzapfel was designed for cabinet makers. And that sounds like a stupid distinction, but it's not. You know, if you do a lot of dovetailing, the Holtzapfel is, you know, fairly ideal for that, which is more of a cabinet making operation. You know, dovetailing on the Rubo, if you don't have some sort of, you know, double screw vise like the Moxon double screw vise or some other way of dovetailing, it can be a little bit of a trick, because especially when you get into dovetailing casework. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's really the big distinction between them, is that the Rubo is for joiners who specialized in mortise and tenon joinery and, you know, long lengths of moldings and things like that, whereas Holtzapfel was really for the fine cabinet maker.
Okay.
Now, both could be used for either, but that's just what they specialized in.
Gotcha. Okay. So speaking of the Moxon vise, then, do you think that's a pretty good add-on if someone is building a Rubo?
I think it's probably the best add-on that I've ever found to a bench. I mean, I've built six or seven of them and then another dozen with students. And I have been using the heck out of it, and I can't find any disadvantages. It would be my first accessory for a Rubo bench. It saves your back. Just saves your back when dovetailing.
And if you are absolutely sure, excuse me, that you want to put the Moxon on there, do you then make any height adjustments? It's actually partially a question from TexFire. Do you make any adjustments to the height that allow that to work better, or maybe make the Rubo a little bit lower since you know you're gaining a few inches with the Moxon?
You can. The bench height question really depends on what you do at your bench. I mean, if you do a lot of really fine close-up work, a low bench is going to be a pain.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do a lot of hand planing, and you do a lot of hand planing with wooden planes, which are taller, then yeah, you're gonna gravitate towards the lower bench, and then you can adjust the double screw vise so that it you know, makes your forearm parallel to the floor, and so you're not stooping and you're not you know, twisting your arm. So it's really a fluid situation, and I can't give you any one answer. It's put the planing aspect where it needs to be for your tools and your body, and then change the double screw so that you're comfortable sawing.
Okay. This is in a similar vein, might be a little bit redundant, but Bryce Arnold asks, I've heard that the bench is dependent upon not only the user, but what kind of work they will be doing, hand tools versus power tools and routers. If you can only have one bench and the work you do is balanced, hand tools and power tools, how should this influence the bench height? Average, he says, average between high for power tools and low for hand tools? And could you reiterate the rule of thumb for, I think what you just touched on, the rule of thumb for bench height in general?
Yeah, it's really the rule of the pinky, not the thumb. it's the joint. I find that unless you are Mongoloid armed, and sorry to the Mongoloid armed listeners among us, but unless you have these real knuckles, scabby knuckles, you're going to look at that joint between your pinky and your hand, and that's about the right height for a good balance between hand and power. For me, that's 34 inches. For you, it might be different. Mm-hmm. It will be different. And you know, when you find that, I'm a very balanced woodworker. I use machines and I use hand tools and a lot and both. And when if you get to that point, when you need to do close up work, you sit on a stool or you sit on your tool chest or something, you know, that gets your face close to the work.
Sure.
And that pretty much takes care of all my problems with the low bench is I sit down because the theme of the day is I am lazy.
Right. Well, you know what? And if you're there for a long time and you're doing, you know, some really exact joinery and you want to get, you know, your face close to the work, well, not too close, but close enough just to really concentrate, you know, there's nothing worse than rushing through that part of the process. So take a seat on a stool is kind of a good way to remind yourself to slow down a little bit.
Oh, sure.
Okay, moving on to the wood. I've sort of got the questions here grouped into the wood, the hardware, and construction. So we'll jump right through them. All right, so for the wood, generally speaking, do you have a preference for harder woods or softer woods? And then also secondary question is, would you consider using different woods for the base and the top in an effort to just save money?
Oh, I've done all those things. I mean, I've built benches out of cottonwood and all manner of nasty, nasty woods. And I've built very nice benches out of curly maple and curly ash. Mm-hmm. You know, the rules for workbench woods are that it needs to be dry. It needs to be stable. It needs to be stiff. It's great if it's heavy. And most of all, the traditional bench, the wood was the cheapest thing that met all those other qualifications. So you don't need to spend a crap load of money on steamed European beech or hard maple. Fir makes a great bench top once it's dry. It makes a great base too. Mm-hmm. But I'll use almost anything. You really, unless you are somebody who has anger management problems, you're generally not pounding your bench directly. So softness isn't all that big a deal.
Yeah.
Really, you just want stiff and you want heavy.
Do you find, I'm just curious if you find that this, that sort of allowing soft woods or softer woods into the workbench realm to be a little bit counter the advice we've been given for a long time now? Because I know, you know, early days in forums when, you know, the web stuff was really just starting to take off, if you built a workbench, you're most likely would be advised to make it out of hard maple. And that's what I made my first bench out of. And now it seems, and I'm sure a large part of it is your voice in the community is saying that, no, wait, you know, softer woods, less expensive woods are certainly not only viable, but possibly even recommended. Depending on the type of work you're doing, or like you said, whether you have anger management problems. So was there sort of a general consensus before, or is that just sort of a bias that I had from where I might have been hanging out on the intertubes?
Yeah. Certainly in the last 50, 60 years, almost every bench discussion has talked about hard maple or steamed beech. Mm-hmm. But the historical record is filled with a wide variety of benches made out of everything and anything, yeah. You know, just sort of a patchwork of whatever was available. I don't think that anybody in, really gave it that much thought. I mean, yeah, they would love to have some oak and they would love to have some maple if they had it. But I've seen benches, really old benches made out of white pine.
Well, and it just makes sense, though, if you think back, we're a lot of times we as, hobbyist level woodworkers or, you know, even pro woodworkers who write about the topic, we may have the luxury to think about what types of woods, what would be the ideal wood. But if you're someone who's building for a living, you're going to take what you have the most of for the cheapest amount of money and just slap it together. The workbench is just a tool. So it makes sense that they would just use whatever they could get a lot of at a very cheap price.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, Bjorn asks, I recently got a good amount of quarter-sawn old-growth Douglas fir. These are former floorboards. If we assume that money is a secondary concern, would you recommend building the workbench top from that wood, or is there something better?
Wow. If you don't want it, I'll give you my address.
I mean, it sounds perfect, right? I mean,
it's just awesome. I mean, fir is so stiff. It's as almost as stiff as maple if you look at its modulus of elasticity, and it's heavy. And especially if it's old growth, and I mean, that's just a dream.
And it doesn't sound like he either got it for free or got it really cheap. So,
oh gosh, I'd be all over that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Jumping into the hardware. So now I don't want to focus too much because I realize you're not a Benchcrafted representative, but, since we are including the Benchcrafted hardware, some of these questions skew in that direction. So what do you think of the Benchcrafted hardware in general, and how does it compare to a lot of the other options that you may have tried?
Yeah, I just finished writing a feature article on Jamil Abraham and his brother and his father who run Benchcrafted for the Fine Tool Journal. And, you know, after thinking about it for a good long time, I have to say that, you know, the three best vices I've ever used in my life are all Benchcrafted, and Benchcrafted only makes three vices. So
nice.
It's the best stuff I've ever used. And, yes, there are some, complexities with installing it that may put you off on it. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly a valid concern. Installing the tail vise is a piece of work, especially if you're doing a retrofit, as I did. If you're doing it as new, it's not so bad. I've installed four or five new, and it was pretty easy that way. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you are kind of complexity averse, the best tail vise for you is going to be just slapping a quick release on there. Which is what I have on my Holzoffel downstairs, and works really great. But really, that kind of wagony vise that Jamil has designed gives you so many more advantages over the European style tail vise. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sag. It doesn't lift your work up off the bench. It doesn't create this big no pound zone that those European vices do. Yeah. So that's tremendous. Both Jamil and I are really huge fans of leg vices, and his leg vise is just as slick as snot on a duck's back or something like that.
Oh, wow, that sounds delicious.
Yes. And that's just outstanding hardware, and you can get, it's so simple and it's so flexible compared to the quick release iron vices that I think a lot of us grew up with on our first benches were not designed for woodwork, and generally they were designed for metalwork, and so they really have some limitations that all those guide bars below that the leg vise doesn't.
Sure. Well, speaking of the quick release vices, Torch wants to know, do you have any tips for resources for older quick release vices? And he says, I guess eBay and Craigslist just haven't been cutting it for him.
Yeah, those are going to be tough anyway, just because you may pay, $50 for the vise, but you might spend more than that on the shipping.
Yeah.
It depends on where you live. Out here in the Midwest and on the East Coast, pretty much you can go to flea markets and they will be there. And you can get them for $20 or $30. If you join the Midwest Tool Collectors, they have these and they're not just in the Midwest, they're in the South and everywhere in the East. They have these great, amazing tool swaps, and I picked up quick releases there for very little money. People generally don't want them, but yeah. Anything old and American is going to be just a great buy, because you look at for ones made by Jorgensen or Columbia. I mean, those are just like these relics of early 20th century manufacturing that are nicer than anything anybody makes today.
Okay. Imaginos asks a question that I probably should have asked before when we were talking about the tail vise versus other options. He says, the wagon vise on the split top Rubo is perplexing me. It looks like the hardware is either identical or very similar to a slide L-block tail vise. It seems that with a sliding block and dog holes in the right spots, I can do everything that a wagon vise can do, plus more options for work holding on the right end of the bench, minus a little bit of support where the block slides out. The recurring theme that stands out in Chris's book is efficiency and economy of effort. So what's the downside of the sliding L-block tail vise? What's a wagon vise do that the L block can't?
Yeah. If you really spend a lot of time and a lot of effort, re-engineering the hardware of a traditional L-shaped tail vise, then it can be a good option. As we were discussing earlier, the problem is almost every one of these I've ever used in my entire life, they weigh so much and they're so fragile that they sag. Yeah. And so what happens is, you move the tail vise out and it sags down about half an inch. And then when you clamp your work with it, it brings the tail vise up. And so your work is always lifted off the bench top. Plus also it creates this no pound zone. So you can't assemble down on that end of the bench. Otherwise your tail vise will sag very quickly, as you fatigue it. And the installation is more complex. As somebody I've installed tail vises, the traditional European tail vise and the bench crafted, and, I find the complexity much higher on the European, L block. But, if you like the look and you're willing to, really pay attention to installation and make sure that it can't sag, you're going to be fine. I mean, people have been doing that for hundreds of years, and so it can't be that bad.
Right. Skunk Eye wants to know your thoughts. Some of these names are just great. Skunk Eye would like to know. I try to be serious when I say that.
Yes.
You use the huge wooden screws on some of your leg vices, and he wants to know if you have a preference for the coarse wood threads or metal Acme threaded rods.
The reason I like the wood is, and I know I'm going to be quoted on this, but I like that wood on wood action, which I know is just going to end up.
I'm going to excerpt that right now and put it on Twitter.
Exactly. But it is a very nice, and quick movement, because you're talking about 3 teeth per inch. So you don't think about, boy, I wish this was a quick release. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you get into the metal thread, Acme thread ones, is that it really can take a while, especially if you're going from puting a drawer, planing a drawer down to trying to clamp half inch wide stuff. So it's the speed, and they also, they look badass.
Yeah, they do. Is there any difference in holding power, holding strength, or how much you can crank on it?
No, there is no difference. If you abuse the wooden one, you'll probably break the teeth off.
Sure.
But, we've crushed walnuts with a wooden thread leg vise.
Nice.
And it works great. Yeah. So
very cool. Okay. Chaz wants to know, he wants to use two species in his benchtop. Wow. I misclassified this question. Should have been in the wood section. He wants to use two different species in his benchtop. Do you foresee any problems incorporating different species in places like an end cap, a vice chop, or in the case of the split top Rubo, the dog hole backing strip? So he's just concerned about, maybe he wants to use a harder wood or more premium wood in those areas. Is there any concern with wood movement between the two species in one single top like that?
I'd say it's pretty minor. I have a maple end cap on my yellow pine bench, and I've had to mix up wood species, and as long as they're not radically different in their expansion and contraction rates over the seasons, then no, you're not going to have any problems. And after they settle down, the wood movement is pretty minimal. So just don't mix flat sawn with quarter sawn, really wet with super dry,
right,
and stay out of the extremes. And like always, and you'll stay out of the weeds.
Cool. All right. Moving into construction questions, Jeff B1, I guess Jeff A1 was taken. If my stock permits me to go thicker than 4 inches, is that recommended? And actually, let me put in the second question because it relates directly. Baron says, in your book, you indicate that holdfasts don't work as well if the top is too thick. Is there a problem with holdfast holding if you make the top thicker than 4 inches?
4 inches seems to be about where a lot of holdfasts start to lose their grip. And, we made a whole bunch of sections and tested holdfasts and found the kind of range where they seem to work the best. Now, you can get really springy or really heavy holdfasts that'll do okay in 4-plus inch thick tops. And you can also modify the holdfasts. You can rough them up with a file, and that helps them grab. You can also just counterbore underneath the the hole with a big Forstner and effectively reduce the thickness of the top in the eyes of the holdfast.
Oh, that's a neat trick.
Yeah, you can get away with a lot of stuff, and that works great. I've done that on tops, and so, you know, you just bore down. If it's 5 inches thick, counterbore an inch, and Bob's your uncle.
So do you think going thicker offers advantages? Like if someone, for instance, has access to thicker boards and they may be able to go 5 to 6 inches in total thickness, is that recommended?
Well, Rubeau's benches, he spec'd up to 6 inches thick, I believe. And I've seen really thick tops, and you're not getting any more stiffness after that point, because the stiffness is sort of a logarithmic equation. So after about 4 inches, you know, you could park a car on a bench made out of pine. But when you what you do change is you change the balance of the eye, the look of the bench, and they start to look kind of heavy browed and Mongoloidian or something. I mean, they're right. Neanderthalic. They tend to look out of balance. So that's why I try to keep that. I have one that's like 4.5, 4.75 thick, and I started at about 5.5 thick, and it just didn't look right. So
yeah. Okay. Bjorn wants to know: do you think a workbench top is best made from a lamination of smaller boards, or is it better to go with a couple of massive slabs? Is there any advantage one way or the other?
I prefer the massive or the bigger pieces of wood just because I'm lazy. If I can get one slab, then there's no glue up.
Right. Less work.
Yeah, it is less work. I usually try to build them out of four pieces. And so I only have three glue lines, but you know, my first Rubeau, which I built out of 21 or 22 laminations, it holds up fine. There's no functional difference or strength difference. It's just the amount of glue and the amount of work it takes to put it all together. So, you know, I think the monolithic slabs look nicer. But once again, you know, it's a workbench and it's going to get dirty and knocked up. That's not the right word.
Not sure what you're doing with your benches, Chris, but the way I use them.
A special finish. But did I say that?
I don't know, but I'm not editing that out.
Okay. Well, let's go either way.
All right. Okay. So I'll move on quickly. We'll pretend that didn't happen. HHH wants to know if you have a preferred lamination pattern if you're making the top out of thinner boards. Let's say, like we're recommending in the guild, just for simplicity, to source 8-quarter stock for it. So do you think there's a preferred way to laminate those pieces together, just in terms of the orientation, maybe looking at the end grain orientation?
I don't look at the end grain as much as I look at the edge grain. You know, if you're turning them on edge to laminate them, I want them to look consistent, because you know, I'm just one of those fussy people, and I'm always looking at, well, I have to stare at this for the rest of my life. So
right.
I'm going to orient the edges so that it looks right to me. And so that's really more the major concern. And as far as laminating or you know, putting them together, I usually just, you know, laminate together whatever I can get together and put over my joiner and then through my planer, and then put those slabs together when I'm putting together 8-quarter stuff. So that's the usual mode.
Do you have any concerns for grain direction, just for the simplicity of planing?
I do try to orient the grain direction, you know, from so that it's running uphill from right to left. So when I flatten it, I get the least amount of tear out possible. But once again, you know, I'm going to make it look, I want it to look its best. Mm-hmm. And also, if I can't get the grain direction running the way I want it, I don't really cry much, because it's a bench, and I've got tear out all over my bench.
Right. Well, I think that's the biggest realization for a lot of folks, is we look at this, you know, just like a massive furniture project. And in reality, it's so much more utilitarian than that, that you just don't have to really concern yourself with those finer details like that. If it's heavy, flat, and holds your work, it's kind of doing what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
I don't need to tell you that. Okay, so Torch has a question. He says, in your books, you've implored people to build as big and sturdy of a bench as they can. If neither cost nor space were an issue, what would be that ideal size?
You know, I'd love to have a 12-foot bench. Ooh. That would be, you know, 10 or 12. I've made 8s. I made some 10s. in classes with people. The 10s are nice. I've seen 14s. When you get into 12 and 14 foot benches, the problem becomes that you need to add another set of legs, or at least one more leg in the middle. Mm-hmm. So you do introduce some complexity. And so for that reason, Mark, I'm going to have to go with the 10 foot bench, because I don't really have to modify anything else. I can do 8 foot of molding in one run. I can stick 8 feet of molding on there with a molding plane. So, you know, a 10-foot bench is good for that. Wow. So I'd probably go with, you know, 20 inches wide, 10 feet long, and that would be probably the bench that would serve me best.
Wow. Do you find that there's any more instance of twist or anything when you have a bench that long?
Oh, God, no. Yeah. Once you put all that heavy weight in the legs and everything's put together, I've never seen a top twist over time. I'd like to see that.
I'm trying to imagine this bench that long. That's awesome. Okay, Skunk Eye again. He's back. He says, do you have a preference for square or round dog holes, or do you like to have both in a workbench?
Wow. You know, historically, I mean, the first bench dogs were round because they were lazy, because you can make a round bench dog hole wherever you want with a drill.
Right.
So, you know, you can add hold fast holes, or you can use hold fast holes and dog holes are interchangeable. And that's why I generally prefer round. The squares, what's nice about them is they don't rotate. Like when you have to clamp something that's slightly irregularly sized, a round dog will twist and sometimes lose its grip, whereas a square dog obviously won't. The square dogs are a pain in the butt to install. Mm-hmm. And then once you install them, you're done. I mean, you can't like say, hey, I want another dog row here, because right. you just can't do that unless you saw apart your bench. So I think I like the round just because they're faster, they're easier. You know, it's all getting back to the I'm lazier speech, right. but that's really what it is. You know, just boom, 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 you're done.
Well, there's a lot of commercial products available out there too. And you know, I know Lee Valley has those, the hold fast that I bought for like $80 a piece, really expensive, but they're really awesome. You know, and then they all fit into 3/4 inch round holes. So it's nice to at least, even if you have square dog holes, I know like the split top Rubo design still has round holes on it, not necessarily for dogs, but for other work holding implements that you might want to add.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Lee Valley and the 3/4 inch dog hole empire.
So, right. Okay. So here's a good question. Your thoughts again from Skunk Eye. What are your thoughts on bench storage, and should a bench be for work holding only? So I guess in terms of things like drawers and tool trays and whatnot.
Well, I don't like to add, you know, a bunch of cabinets. I don't like to turn my bench into a bathroom vanity. And because, you know, it restricts what you can do, how you can add clamps to it, because I'm always clamping assemblies down to my bench to kind of spread out the clamp pressure when I do assemblies. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to get the clamp bars, unable to get a clamp bar underneath my bench. That said, I think you have to have at least a shelf. I mean, every traditional old bench has a shelf, and that's where you, you know, you put your planes or your or the stock you're working on that day, and sort of store the jigs that you're going to use all the time. Rubo also has, in his so-called German bench, he puts drawers underneath that shelf, so that gives you some storage. But I think, you know, you can play with it. I mean, there are benches I've seen that actually work where you can get a clamp in there and you still have some drawers and trays below. But it is a balance.
Yeah. So tool trays, is that something that's just a place to collect crap, or do you think they've got some value being attached to a bench?
The best thing I like about tool trays is when you can remove the bottoms of them, so you can, you know, get a clamp in there and do what you suggested, which is, you know, clamp something to it and get it clamp bar up really high. That's where they excel. But generally, my first bench was my grandfather's, and it had a tool tray, and it was generally just where I would lose stuff. And so I've never been a fan of tool trays after having to use one for so long. Mm-hmm. And so I've generally tried to stay away from it. But, you know, if you're the kind of person who's really fastidious and clean and you knit a cozy for all your tools, then you're probably going to be just fine with a tool tray, but right. not me, man.
Okay. Tom Buell wants to know, and this is pertaining to the specifically how the bench crafted design is meant to be pretty much portable, you know, to knock it down. So he wants to know, do you think a full mortise and tenon versus the barrel bolt hardware approach, which one do you think might be better? He says in your book that you didn't think very highly of the barrel bolt approach.
No, I like the barrel bolt approach. I mean, I don't think it's I don't think there's any rigidity or sturdiness questions. Mm-hmm. You know, I've used the Veritas bench bolts, and I've messed with the Benchcraft, that I haven't actually used them on a bench. You know, that's an outstanding way to put a bench together and keep it tight over time. Mm-hmm. There's no loss in strength whatsoever. I just was trying to explore old methods when I built those Roubaud benches and find out, you know, what was there a difference? And there isn't really a difference. If you want to knock down your bench bolts, those big bench bolts are great.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Good to know. Tom also asks, excuse me, what are your thoughts on how short a Roubaud bench should be? I guess this is the opposite question that we had before concerning the length of the bench. In practical terms, and still use the Benchcrafted tail vise. I guess his space can only handle about 6 feet. So is there a lower limit that you would recommend if you're going to add something like a Benchcrafted tail vise?
You can make a 6 foot long bench and use the Benchcrafted tail vise hardware. You're just going to have to, you know, shift the top to the right on the base to give yourself enough overhang on the right side. But no, I have 6 foot benches, and that's a cabinet maker size, a modern cabinet making size. You're not going to cry over a 6 foot bench at all. It's when you get below, as you get towards 4 feet, that's when things start to get tight, because, you know, most cabinet parts top out at about 4 feet long.
Yeah.
And you need some, you know, infeed and outfeed on the bench a little bit. So, you know, as you get close to 4 feet, that's when things start to get really difficult.
Okay. Now, Tom also has another question. He's got, in his shop, he has to move things out to the driveway to kind of get work done. He says, so he needs it to be mobile, and he was thinking about doing the flip down wheel bar that was shown on the LVL bench that he saw at WIA. So he's wondering, for something with the substantial size and heft of the Roubaud, is that concept something that you think might work?
Oh yeah, I think it would work as long as you are able to lift, you know, one end, and when you kick the wheels under it. There's another option what are these things called? Man, I'll have to send you the link, but they're used in factory carts for moving, you know, 1,000, 2,000 pound machines. Mm-hmm. And, you can probably get a set of four for, you know, a few hundred bucks if you really want the nice option. But those are the only thing I've seen that really lock down, so that when the bench is engaged, it's really engaged with the floor and doesn't slide around. And then when you put it up, just by pumping, a lever, then it's really super mobile, and you can move it with, you know, one hand. That's the industrial solution, and I'll try to send you a link on that. I wrote a blog entry on it a million years ago.
Okay, cool. Do you have, this is from HHH, do you have an adhesive preference for bench building, PVA, epoxy, hide glue, et cetera?
I generally use PVA because it dries really quickly, especially when I'm doing laminations. Mm-hmm. And you know, I want to get the clamps off, you know, after however short I can get away with. So that's why I'm not going to use liquid hide, which generally you should leave in the clamps a long time. Same with epoxy. Epoxy also is just a pain to clean up. Mm-hmm. And once you run it through the joiner or planer, it's going to be murder on your knives. Plain old PVA is as long as you've got a nice clean glue line, is going to be great.
Cool. This is the last two questions I have for you here, really were asked numerous times by lots of different people. We recently posted on the Wood Whisperer site, sort of exploring different end cap options. And this was just something, just as part of the guild, what we like to do is just ask questions about different things and propose different ideas, not to necessarily say we're making something better, but to just say, you know, could this be more useful for someone else with different requirements? So one of those things was the end cap. And in the construction of the split top, one of the things that I thought was fairly appealing was the fact that before you do your final flattening, you could actually send both of these half slabs through the planer and just kind of clean off the top and start out with a pretty darn flat thing to begin with.
Yeah.
So thinking down the line, okay, should we allow for the possibility that someone may want to do that again in the future? Granted, things may move and it may not be flat on the underside anymore. And it may really just be a whole lot easier to grab a number 7 or number 8 and flatten it yourself manually. But we thought, you know, we should at least talk about this as an option. So we redesigned the end cap so that it would actually be removable. So there was a lot of backlash to that because a lot of people were like, what are you, crazy? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. So they wanted your opinion on that, whether you think it even makes sense to worry about that because it's just so much easier to grab a hand plane and do it. So the thought would be you'd be able to pop that end cap off and then once again run that front slab through the planer without having any issues.
Yeah. Well, in the end cap jihad, you know, sort of, I don't know where I'm going to come down if I'm going to get firebombed for this, but I like to make my end caps, you know, easily installed and removable. I don't dovetail them on. I use giant long 7 or 8 inch long carriage bolts and just bolt them to the end and with a ratchet. And they stay, they don't move and they don't give me any trouble. And that can be easily, very easily removed in case you need to ever do any maintenance, you know, or, you know, switch something out or, you know, flatten the top. You know, if I had the option of, you know, running 2 independent slabs through the planer or over the joiner, I think I definitely would use that as a good starting spot, especially if, you know, the top got really scarred or got a lot of, you know, dye on it or messed up. I would have no problems doing that. I think that's a real plus.
Okay, cool. Yeah, we came up with 3 different designs. One allowing it to be removed and the other was just foregoing the dovetail altogether just to kind of simplify things for folks who are a little intimidated by the process. But it was interesting, of course, you know, you say something like that and you're building a workbench and you get a lot of people who are like, what are you, crazy? You know, you're building a workbench. Why wouldn't you just use your planes to do it? But options. Like to have options.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, well, let's finish with the finish. A lot of people want to know, what is your preferred workbench finish?
Boy, we've tested a lot of finishes. We went through Landis's book on workbenches, and he had several recipes where you have to heat the beeswax with the balm of forbidden trees and rub it in the full moon stuff, which, you know, we tried all that. And then we also used a bunch of other finishes, including the simplest finish that I've kind of come to like and which now Lee Nielsen uses too, which is to take equal parts paint thinner, like varnish, spar varnish even, because that's usually easy to find, a long oil varnish, and boiled linseed oil. Mix those in and 2 coats of that and you're pretty much done. And what that finish does is it you know, the oil helps prevent the water base glue from, you know, sinking in if you do get any glue drips on your workbench. The little bit of varnish in it helps, you know, provide, seal up the wood a little bit so that if you spill some dye or stain on it, you usually have the ability to wipe it up without it penetrating too deeply. And the paint thinner makes it easy to rag on. And so I keep it pretty simple, and I have just been thrilled with that finish. And once I showed Tom Lee Nielsen sort of how we did it, he switched over to that from – he was using straight oil. Yeah. And the little bit of varnish I think really does help.
Sure. You know, on that same vein, how do you do your finish prep for a bench? Do you like to keep things fairly rough or you just leave it right off, you know, plane tracks and everything? Or do you actually prefer a slightly smoother surface?
Well, you don't want it to be slippery. Yeah. You know, you know, 18th century joiners would even rough up their bench tops with a toothed plane. I know, you know, several people have brought that point up. So to give it the bench top some grab, so your stock isn't sliding all over, no matter what you're doing, you know, I mean, sure. I don't know if it's a hand tool or power tool. So I leave plane tracks and, you know, tear out, I see as a bonus. So I'm not going for, you know, a perfect finish. I want flat and, I want it to not be too, you know, too slick. The other option that I've seen people use, and this is what I used on my, my floor in my shop. When I put in a wood floor, the guy put down he's the one who hit me to this, is he put down 1 coat of water-based finish. And the 1 coat of water-based, left, you know, it sort of it raised the grain a little bit and made the floor really, really grippy. Yeah. But it also protected the floor from, you know, getting stains on it. Sure. So that's another thing that I've recommended to people who have used it, you know, especially if you're out west where a lot of these solvent-based finishes are even banned.
Right.
You know, one coat of water-based and not raising the grain beforehand can actually make this really kind of toothy surface that is nice.
You know, I actually made a crosscut sled for my table saw recently, and it was one of those things where I was making it quickly for, you know, for the show and didn't think to sand the surface. And I did hit it with a little water-based finish and, of course, didn't pre-raise the grain. And I just started using it. And then the more I used it, I was like, you know what? I'm actually digging this grippiness that I have, especially, you know, if I'm not going to clamp every piece to the fence, it just gives you a nice extra security that it feels like it's not going to be sliding all over the place. So definitely the same concept with the workbench. It makes perfect sense. All right.
Yeah, I've always wondered why, you know, why do miter saws, chop saws have this really slick, shiny surface, you know?
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense because, you know, you want the work to stay in one place whenever you cut it or do whatever to it. So,
sure.
I agree.
Well, very cool, Chris. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And the Guild was really excited about this, as you could see from the questions in the forum. So I'm glad we could carve out the time to chat. And so lostartpress.com is where everybody can find anything and everything concerning what you're up to these days. And also you're still, as mentioned earlier, on the Popular Woodworking blog. So I know people can look forward to seeing your blog posts. And, you know, how do you do it? You write so much. What is it? Is it like, do you do drugs? What? How is it possible?
It's really... The thing is, Mark, you know, I was a newspaper journalist and we usually turn out 500 stories a year and you just get used to that that pace. And when I switched to magazines from newspapers, I found like I was blocked, you know, it was clogged or something.
Right.
And thank God for blogging so that I can get back to this pace of writing this amount. It sounds silly, but you know, if I don't write, I get very crabby. So it's a need. It's my need. I don't care about you.
Well, right. Well, the good thing is there's a pretty insatiable appetite out there for this stuff, and frankly, your love and promotion of the craft, and you know how much you clearly enjoy the craft is contagious, and I think you've inspired a lot of people to push forward and just become better and you know just more active woodworkers in the community. So I thank you personally for that. All right, Chris. Well, thanks for hanging out with us, and I won't subject this to you. I won't subject you to this again for a while. Maybe we'll have you back in the future after the benches are built, and maybe some people will have different questions after the benches are sitting in their shops.
No, Mark, I'm always happy to talk to you.
Cool. Thanks, Chris. Have a wonderful. Well, I don't even know what day it is. That's what having a kid does to you. Have a wonderful Tuesday, Chris.
Same to you.
All right. Take care. Once again, you could follow all of Chris's exploits at lostartpress.com. A big thanks to all the guild members who supplied me with the questions, and I hope Chris's advice will inspire and guide you as you start your own workbench build.